Open to Genesis chapter 15. Sorry, Exodus. Thank you for that correction. And if there are corrections as I'm reading a text and I add a couple zeros to numbers, you can correct me right away. It makes the story more interesting, and we don't want to spoil a good story with facts, right? We definitely want to spoil a good story by Andrew with biblical facts, so you can interrupt many times. Exodus, thank you. Chapter 15. I remember what happened in chapter 14. It was the Exodus, the event that we call the Exodus. Out of Egypt after the 10 plagues, through the Red Sea in a most miraculous way, and finally, for the people of Israel, the purpose of Exodus thus far was accomplished. Verse 31 of chapter 14, Israel saw the great power that Yahweh used against the Egyptians, so the people feared Yahweh, and they believed in Yahweh and in his servant Moses. Finally, they knew who Yahweh was. Then chapter 15 comes. And it's grand exaltation that crashes and burns very quickly. But let's start with the grand exaltation. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to Yahweh, saying, I will sing to Yahweh, for he has trumpeted triumphs gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. Yahweh is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. Pharaoh's chariot and his host he cast into the sea, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea. The floods covered them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, Yahweh, glorious in power, your right hand, O Yahweh, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you overthrow your adversaries. You send out your fury, it consumes them like stubble. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up, the flood stood up in a heap, the deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil, my desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. This song up to now is simply starting somewhat repetitively, especially the way it's recorded for us, with, we're going to sing to Yahweh. Hey, Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to Yahweh, saying, the first line of the song is, I will sing to Yahweh. That's the first written line of the song. This is obvious worship through song of Yahweh. Now keep this in mind because it's going to be very important later on by way of a contrast, unfortunately. This is vocal, expressive worship. It's a component of worship, not full worship, obviously, it's just song. But it's for everything he has done. He has triumphed gloriously. How do we know that? Well, there are no more people pursuing us. They're literally, the horse and its rider died in the Red Sea. Do you see how practical this worship is? Literally, just take the past event. What happened a minute ago? And praise God for it. Verse 2 is striking. In the preposition, my. Sorry, not preposition. No, I'm blanking on. What is it? Pronoun. Thank you, high school kids. Pronoun. Yahweh is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation or deliverance. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. It's the only line in the song that is like that. The only other time you get it in at least the section we read is when the enemy says, I will, I will, I will. Okay, this is a song sung by all the people of Israel, a couple million people, but it's a song from each worshiper's heart. It's very, very personal. And in verse 3, immediately expands again to a bit of the theme here and just objective truths about the Lord. The Lord is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. This testimony of 14 verse 31, where they finally knew who Yahweh was. Remember the purpose of Exodus so far, that they might know who I am. The Egyptians, the Israelites, everybody. Israelites get it, end of chapter 14. And now it becomes their confession, becomes their anthem. In fact, and you'll see this again at the end of Deuteronomy, before the entry of the promised land to the next generation. This, in the beginning of the whole story, becomes a bit of what would be the national anthem of Israel as a new nation. They were delivered, they're on their way to Mount Sinai to get all God's laws for their nation. And this, in many ways, becomes their national anthem. Okay, this is there in Kosi Sikale. And they're going to sing this. And the first stanza is simply an affirmation that Yahweh is our God. His name is Yahweh. That's how you know Him. That is our God. Everybody should know Him. And we know Him. We got our revelation from Him. That's coming soon in Sinai. And we are the testimony to the world that we are people whose God is the Lord. And then in verse 4 to 10, it's a very poetic, expressive way of demonstrating just how amazing this God of theirs is. And so this is really, if it's a national anthem, and you think of it as such, this is where you would show up at the ancient version of, let's say, the Olympics every 4 years. And an Israelite would come on the track, and there would be the Israelite flag, whatever it looked like then. And they would sing, as that team comes on or something like that, they would sing, Yahweh is His name, let me tell you about Him. Okay, so it's an absolutely amazing anthem. It's the story of the Exodus. God's right hand is glorious and power is contrasted with verse 9, where the enemy thinks they are glorious and power. Imagine singing this before a sports event. Our God is might and power. You think. Okay. And then verse 10. How did God win with His almighty power? He went. He just blew. This great army. You blew with your wind or with your breath. And won. Yeah, the athlete didn't even partake. You just blew and won the races. Verse 11 then. Who is like you, O Yahweh, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Now there's a confession to stick on the back of your car. Who is like Yahweh among all the gods? Majestic in holiness, completely set apart. That's the answer to the question. He is majestic in being set apart from everything else. He's not part of a group of gods that fight against each other. It's just an all different category. Verse 12, you have stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed him. You have led in your steadfast love, chesed there, the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. Because of the greatness of your arm, they are still as a stone. Till your people, O Yahweh, pass by. Till the people pass by whom you have purchased. You will bring them in and plant them on your holy, on your own mountain. The place, O Yahweh, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established, Yahweh will reign forever and ever. That's a little chorus at the end. Okay, at the end, majestically, crescendo, right? Yahweh will reign forever and ever. This song starts, pauses in the middle, and ends with identifying and communicating the nature of Yahweh to the people. Starts that way, Yahweh is His name. In the middle of like, who is like Yahweh? And at the end it says, we told you everything about Yahweh, now He's the one who reigns for it. It's interesting there in verse 14 and 15, you've got all these nations that are their future problems. They're not problems yet. Egypt, we just dealt with in the first stanza. Second stanza, after verse 11, is looking and saying, wait, we're going to pass Moab. First Edom and Moab. We're going to have Canaan on the left. Philistia is going to be a bit further. We're running into troubles. And already, that problem is solved. Why? Because they heard what a God named Yahweh did to Egypt. Terror and dread fall upon them. They are still like a stone. You either sink like a stone, verse 5, like the Egyptians, or when God comes by with his people, you don't move. You just let them pass. Do anything. Okay? Just like a rock on the side of the road. Don't move. You're just in the desert. If you don't move, they won't know you're there. They won't do anything to you. Just let them pass. And it says here, until they're going to be in dread of Yahweh with Israel until the people pass and enter the promised land, where God is then going to take them to a place of sanctuary, his holy mountain. This is not a reference to Sinai. It's a reference to what's going to be Jerusalem. God's going to make them a place there where they can worship him. And so, past troubles are done. Finally done. The Red Sea is a final victory. Nobody's pursuing anymore and won't pursue. The future problems, this one took care of that, so we're sorted. And so we're going to go and worship. And that implies that the rest of the nations will stay terrified of them. Because if they are pleasing this God is going to take care of them. And so, it's a bit of a prophetic look saying, nation of Israel, if you maintain your worship through obedience, through praise at the sanctuary and obedience, everybody will always be in dread of you. And so if you ever in your future have a problem with Moab or Edom or Philistia or Canaan, unfortunately that's going to happen very quickly. But it's going to be an indication that the dread of God has fallen away from them because they know you're not worshiping that God anymore. That God owes you nothing. Keep that in mind. It's a big setup here for the rest of the chapter. Verse 19. Verse 19 is actually a continuation of verse 1. It's no longer the song. The song ended with the Yahweh will reign forever and ever. So let's read verse 1 and then jump to verse 19. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang the song to Yahweh. The song is listed. For, verse 19, when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, Yahweh brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. It's a bit of a commentary on why this song was written. And it's simply referring back to chapter 14, events we already read. Then, back to the history now. Then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand. And all the women went out after her with tambourines and dancing. And Miriam sang to them, sing to Yahweh, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea. Making us think that maybe this whole song was Miriam's prophecy. She's a prophetess, it's said here. We know later even she affirms that she has been prophesying. It's actually in a rebellion context. In fact, quick peek ahead. Micah 6 verse 4 indicates that God brought the Exodus about through Moses and Aaron and Miriam. She's actually included that one time. And so she played some very significant role in the entire Exodus. We're not told any of it. It's not the point of Exodus. But here we're told that already she was known as a prophetess, a prophet, female prophet, from the Lord. And maybe this song was a revelation from God to Miriam, who then started this ceremony of dancing with the nation of Israel. And so Moses and people sang this song. Miriam seems to maybe take over a little bit then and say, well, let's keep singing the song. Okay, she starts with that first line again that we saw in verse 1. Wonderful, amazing display of God's power in the 10 plagues in the Red Sea, particularly. Remember, Egypt came and hunted them after 10 plagues. They thought they were done with Egypt. They weren't. Egypt came. But now they're officially done with Egypt. This grand exaltation. involving Moses as the established prophet of Yahweh, spokesman of Yahweh, involving even Miriam and her gifting and whatever way it was used, the people are now worshiping truly. Or not, unfortunately. Then, verse 22, Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea. And already you're asking yourself, wait, why does it say the Lord made them set out? Up to now, the Lord was doing everything. Why is the wording changed here in the narration of the events? It doesn't mean the Lord wasn't there. It just says Moses made them set out from the Red Sea. Where's the pillar of cloud? Pillar of fire leading them? Well, it's there. It's just not, the narration is focused on the earthly things. God is for a moment forgotten. They went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in a wilderness, found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah. Marah means bitter. And the people grumbled. There's your new theme for the book of Exodus. Well, one of the themes. The new key word is the word worship. I mean grumble. It's not worship. The people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried to Yahweh, and Yahweh showed him a log, and he threw it in the water, and the water became sweet. There Yahweh made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, "If you will diligently listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, and do what is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will pour none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am Yahweh your healer." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. That last word tells you the reason for how they go from supposedly true worship and song to utter failing the test of devotion. It was over water. It was over water. God just killed an entire Egyptian army with water. Do you think he's in control of all the things on earth? You know God is control of after the Exodus is water. He can make it go away if he wants it to be dry. He can make it sink an army if he wants it to be lots of it. They failed in their worship instantly. If the need initially, right, they're looking for water, it's the wilderness, the desert. Wilderness is such an unfortunate translation in English. It's kind of, we're stuck with it now because if you were translated as desert, you'd be like, but where's the wilderness wanderings? Okay, desert wanderings doesn't have that we're thing. Wilderness wanderings. Wilderness is not jungle, okay, that way we might use it nowadays, unless you have a Christian background and you know it's a desert. It's desert. They found no water. Not surprising. They came to a place called Marah. Not really high expectations for drinkable water there, even if there is water. It's called bitter. And immediately there's false worship. They grumbled against the God of whom they just sang this song. It's not even a month later. Just a few days later, and they grumbled against Moses. He cries out to Yahweh. He does the right thing. He cries out to this great God who's in control of water. And the Lord shows him a log, just a stump of wood laying there, and says, "Throw it in the water." Now, I literally, one commentator commented on this and said, there is literally no wood or plant in that part of the world that if you throw it in water, makes the water sweet. Okay, this is a miracle. There's a log. Throw it in. It's like Moses' staff, okay? The staff itself has no power, but in the mighty hand of God, it accomplishes all kinds of things. And the water became sweet. It's called Marah because the water has never been sweet there. Then the Lord, here's the point of this exercise. If they are going to fail their worship so quickly, grand in song, but zero in obedience, God says, "Well, we're going to use this. We're going to make a statute here and a rule. I'm going to test your worship. what you think is true in song is only proven true, not when a song ends and a tambourine comes out for the second round. We're going to test your worship when the song ends by giving you a difficult situation and see if you, like Moses, cry out to me or if you doubt everything you just say. You actually don't obey the practical things that are difficult. Easy for a believer, but if you don't believe, you're going to consider it the end of the world and you're not going to do what is right. He tested them to prove. It's a test to see if what is there is indeed the real thing. So it looked real with a song, and then God tested it. Let's see if it's real. And then he realized it's not real. Well, they realized it's not real. God knew it all along. The lesson then, verse 26, you have to listen and do what is right in God's eyes. You have to give ear and keep all his statutes. You've got that repetition. Listen in order to do. Then you won't have any of the diseases on the Egyptians, because by very nature, your God, whose name is Yahweh, is a healer, not a destroyer. Now you saw his destruction, and on those who would not obey, who would not let his people go, who would not believe the threats of the plagues. And so don't be that nation. And if you're not that nation, you actually believe what God says, and you do what he says, then God will make you thrive. As healer, it's a good translation, as healer, he will take what is already bad and make it good. But you need not just obedience. It doesn't say just do it. It says listen so you can do. He's talking about devotion. I want to know. I want to lend an ear to what God says. And then I want to do whatever it is. It's devotion. And so this is a bit like, what was that psalm that we did a while back, Psalm 95, that starts with the true worship of Israel and switches to how it was actually false worship. It looked true till there was a test and then they failed. Okay, that's this kind of passage. And then, after this lesson of testing, we're going to test now because you're not truly devoted. You're all excited in your worship and your song especially, but you fall short in practical obedience. We're going to make regular tests here to prove to you what's really going on in your heart. But, just to end the story, here's abundant blessing. They came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. There's plenty of water. You grumbled about water, God can in a miracle change the water to sweet. And then he's like, oh, let's not do that, the place is still called Marah. Let's bring it to Elim. And they show up at Elim, and they're like, okay, plenty of water, no problem here. Okay, springs galore, trees everywhere. Somewhat symbolic with the 12, being the 12 tribes of Israel. It's like, maybe God knows exactly. He's literally like made watering holes for each of us and our tribes. Plenty of abundant care. This is a bit of a shock chapter, and I'm glad in our chapter breaks that this Marah story is actually part of chapter 15, so you don't just too easily stop there. Read the song, round two with Miriam presumably, and Marah in one go. And realize what was wrong with Israel. It's not that they were unbelieving, rebellious, I won't listen to God, Pharaoh, and Egyptians. They would explode in worship once they got to know who God was. But then the very next difficult thing God tells them to do is just like, trust me with water. Like, no, let's grumble instead. Chapter 16. They set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. It's just a name, okay? It's not a spiritual reality. Spell it with a Z if you want to make that distinction, maybe Zin. Just a name, not to be confused with the English word sinfulness. It's between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel worshipped God. No, they grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we have died by the hand of Yahweh in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for it brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." They sound like Pharaoh, man. 30 days later, it's 1 month since the Exodus now, they grumble, grumble, grumble. They didn't learn the test, pass the test the first time. God graciously gave them abundance to prove his thing. Next test comes around, they failed instantly. And they even say things like, you know, Moses, I think God, if God wanted us to die, he would at least make us die in Egypt where we had a pot cooking with food. You, on the other hand, brought us out so that we can die of hunger here in the desert. They, round two, failed the test of true devotion. Verse 4, then Yahweh said to Moses, behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was Yahweh who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of Yahweh, because he has heard your grumbling against Yahweh. For what are we that you grumble against us? And Moses said, when Yahweh gives you in the evening meat to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because Yahweh has heard your grumbling, that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against Yahweh. Most repeated word? Grumble. What, in just these verse 7 and 8? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times the word grumble. God says, okay, you're grumbling about bread and meat. I'm going to rain bread on you. Talk about overabundance, like with Elam and the 12 spring. I'll just rain it down on you. Immediately grace on their grumbling. Says, you're grumbling? Okay, I'll give you. I'll let it rain. Like, there'll be plenty. Don't worry. And you'll gather every day, and the sixth day you have to gather twice as you do normally. So Moses and Aaron said this to people, and Moses phrases it in terms of, by this you will know that it wasn't me who brought you out of Egypt to kill you. By this you will know, back to that major theme of Exodus, you will know that Yahweh brought you to this place. And if Yahweh brought you this far, certainly he will take care of you. And you're like, okay, but I said bread and meat. It just says bread here. Well, it ends with an evening you'll get meat. And Moses makes a distinction. And you see this distinction. What happened in verse 22 of the previous chapter? Moses led them. It's very much focused on the people and Moses. Here Moses says, we've been doing this all wrong. From now on, we focus on you and God directly. Because who are we for you to grumble against us? Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before Yahweh. Okay, you're dealing directly with Yahweh. We're just the middle people. For he has heard your keyword, grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of Yahweh appeared in the cloud. I love that. They looked to the wilderness and saw more sand, sand. No, they saw the solution to the sand, sand, sand. Yahweh said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am Yahweh, your God. You haven't seen that many times. Your God. I am your God. Don't you worry. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, like that, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that Yahweh has given you to eat. This is what Yahweh has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You can take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with him. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat, but when the sun grew hot, it melted. Great, abundant provision, as much as you can eat. Okay, this is buffet style. As much as you can eat. And you will know that Yahweh is your God. And they did not know what this thing was. Okay, there's play on words. They know that Yahweh is their God, and then he provides for them, and they're like, we have no idea how he's providing for us. In fact, the word manna, as it was called, is basically a very ancient way of saying, what on earth is this? It literally became the name. Imagine every morning waking up, it's like, okay, kids, 40 years already, I know we're doing this, but please go fetch whatever it is. It is the bread, verse 15, that Yahweh had given you to eat. You don't need to know what it is. You just need to know Yahweh gave it to you. Now, we don't have a lot of description of what it was like. We just know it was as much as you could eat. Moses adds then this thing, because remember, now everything is a test, because your loud singing very quickly proved to be very, very incomplete worship. And so there's a commandment given, says, don't leave it till the next day. God gave two commandments here. He said, gather it and don't keep it. Guess which one of those two commandments they chose to break? They didn't wake up in the morning and say, we want to go hungry today, don't obey the commandment to gather. They say, we want to gather more, so don't listen to God when he says don't. Keep it till the next day. We're going to gather more than we can eat. They did not listen to Moses. What was the test, remember? The test was, you need to, verse 26 already, of the previous chapter, you need to listen and do, you need to give ear and keep. They stopped at that very first one already. They didn't listen, so they didn't keep. Moses was angry with him. And then it just continues. It's wrong what they did. And the next verse says, well, Moses was angry with them, but just keep in mind, every morning, God gave it to them. Every morning, they gathered it. Every morning, they ate as much as they could. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. That almost sounds like there was something built in this food that if the sun shone on it for a few hours, it went bad. Sounds like a natural ruin of the food by God's provident hand. Well, maybe not so natural. Keep reading. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of Israel came and told Moses, he said to them, well, this is what Yahweh has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, holy Sabbath to Yahweh. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to Yahweh. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. You need to put yourself in the mind of an ex-slave, in the shoes of an ex-slave, to understand the significance of this provision. The point in this section is not the food anymore. The point is, if you are, unlike a slave in Egypt, if you are in God's kingdom, there will be one day every 7 days. You don't have to go to work. Anybody like those days? It's going to be weekly. Unheard of. Who on earth tells all their employees every 7 days, go home, don't come to work? Well, for us it's common. We take 2 days. For them, they never had someone so gracious to them. In fact, even the food that had a commandment saying, don't keep it to the next day, changed. The commandment was adapted for the day before the day of rest so that you don't even have to get food on the Sabbath. You can just work a little extra hard the day before and literally do nothing that day. You just eat whatever God blessed you with that week. Makes you realize that the food rotting by the time the sun came up and shone for a while, even if that was natural, God supernaturally made it then preserve for the next day. Or he supernaturally ruined it every other day. Either way, God is supernaturally giving them food and making it easy for them to obey the rules. So in any case, it's going to stink if you disobey. Or if you gather on a Sunday, obviously, it's... Well, we'll read about that another time. Let me know. Go ahead. There will be none. Just work 6 days on the seventh day, rest. It's God's blessing to you. Verse 27, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And you're like, why? When we told you, don't keep it to the next day, you kept it. When we said gather extra, well, then you gathered extra. But then when we said don't gather on Sunday night or Saturday, the Sabbath, Then why? They found none, no surprise. And Yahweh said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws?" He's talking to Moses, but it's obviously to say to the nation. The test of verse 4, right? The test of verse 25 of the previous chapter. "I'm going to test you, I'm going to test you, I'm going to test you." He tells them up front, "You claim to worship me, you're amazed at what I do for you," and then you disobey. And so I'm going to put little tests in that you can prove that you're actually listening. They proved that they weren't listening at all. Verse 29, "See, Yahweh has given you the Sabbath, another gift. Therefore on the 6 days gave you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the 7th day. So the people rested on the 7th day. They failed again. And so God through Moses gives them the instruction again. Says, "Don't go out." And so they listen to that rebuke. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. The point with that is like the 12 springs and the 70 palm trees in Elim, like the raining the food on them the next day when they grumbled the first time about food, so also here it's pleasant, it is nice, it is abundant. It didn't taste tasteless, but was nutritious. It tasted like wafers with honey, little white seed-like things. Sounds like sweets, thank you. Moses said, "This is what Yahweh has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar, put an omer of manna in it, and place it before Yahweh to be kept throughout your generations. As Yahweh commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept." The people of Israel ate the manna 40 years, till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And a question you've been asking the whole time probably is, an omer is the 10th part of an ephah. And now you're asking, what on earth is an ephah? An omer is about 2 liters, just over 2 liters. So every day they could gather about a big Coke bottle full for each person in their house. And that would be enough for the day. On the Friday, you could gather 2 of these, and you could eat the other one on the Sunday, or the Saturday, the Sabbath. And then God says, so think of this. If you gather, if you leave over till the next day in a week, it goes bad. If you keep extra on Friday for Saturday, it doesn't go bad. And if you put one of those jars that you collected, and you put it as a testimony for future generations, it doesn't go bad either. In fact, it ended up in the in the Ark of the Covenant. There's a couple items that were placed there. This was the first one we know of that would one day be placed in the Ark of the Covenant. There would be this jar that Aaron had filled that day, like a time capsule, so that all the future generations can know that I am Yahweh, the one who takes your bad situation and makes it into a nutritious, wonderful situation. I'm Yahweh, your healer. And then verse 35 is a bit of a commentary telling you that even though these events took place then and many of the laws of Exodus would be written at Mount Sinai, that as a book like this was actually compiled near the end of Moses' life, and he quickly added that commentary saying, just keep in mind, God kept doing this to them the entire time. You would think with such a visual daily reminder that the one thing they would never do again is grumble. And so we have high aspirations for chapter 17. The lesson for us though, very, very significant here, is that at the end of the day, like with the nation of Israel, God tests our devotion to prove to us that though we worship Him in many ways, if we do not listen in order to obey whatever commandment comes next, you are not a true worshiper. They were delivered from Egypt delivered. God of my salvation is based on saying as deliverance. God of my deliverance in the Old Testament. Because they were not spiritually regenerate. They had seen all these things. They were worshipping God purely. They thought, and as soon as God told them what to do, they grumbled against God's command and said, actually, we don't think it's a good idea. And so it's a striking lesson for us, though it started so wonderfully. Let us sing to Yahweh, the horse and the rider is thrown into the sea, tambourine, dancing, let's go. And then the next day when it gets thirsty, sing to the Lord with a tambourine and dancing. The horse and rider is thrown into the sea, he's the God who can control all water. And you do that for the rest of your life. That just didn't happen. We are more prone through life to prove our unfaithfulness to God than the faithfulness we think we would. So it's a real humbling lesson for our souls. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, you have taught us amazing things about yourself in the Exodus events, the Red Sea, the song that Moses and Miriam had taught the people. You have taught us amazing things about yourself and how you dealt with a stubborn, disobedient nation, a nation that wouldn't really listen. Oh, they loved the things they loved, but they did not love you, as was evident by practical obedience, well, disobedience. So, Father, stir our hearts to judge our own worship and discern it by how we walk before you each day in our actions, and not merely by how we worship you in our quiet time, or perhaps together as a church. Thank you for being the God who gives us rest in this world that is otherwise so toilsome. Thank you for being the God who provides our daily needs, like bread and meat and water. Father, you've done it for them. You're still the same God. You're Yahweh, our healer, too. The one who takes our bad situations and makes it situation of blessing, if only we will listen and if only we will. So Lord, we thank you for your testimony of yourself to us through this. Keep us faithful in our obedience this week as we go our ways from corporate worship and enter this world. Lord, help us guard our thoughts, our words, our actions at work to be faithful and be providers and take care of our responsibilities as we go into neighborhood relationships, whatever it might be. May we be salt and light, not so much by what we say, but by how we live, not taking your name in vain, claiming to worship you, but falling short of actual faithfulness. Keep us faithful, therefore, for Christ's sake.